I mean, it's a long weekend, and you're here. You really have no friends now, do you? Undoubtedly. Are you not the social animal you used to be? Settling down now? Begin to realize that there is something more to life than just having fun? Or it's got to be that you are beginning to realize what real fun is. Partying and dancing and singing and all that, that's also fun. But you're beginning to realize that there's a fun that exceeds and goes beyond that. Unconditional fun. I think you're beginning to realize that. Otherwise, how do you explain this? I remember my long weekends. I wouldn't give it up for the world. Going to a sermon was not one of the things I wanted to do on a long weekend. At least until I came across a teaching, the Buddha's teaching. And it opened my eyes. So, welcome everyone. It's good to see you all. I want to try and make it worth your while. You do your part, and the Mahasangha will do theirs. I think together, we can make miracles happen. So let's begin then. We've got a lot to get through today. I think we can start off with just a refresher of what we discussed last week. I think it was a good session for all concerned. We were discussing the illusion of beauty, weren't we? How the mind creates what doesn't exist. So we'll make a start with some of that, and then we'll go on to discuss the inner workings of the mind. In fact, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you're here to discover who you are and how you work and how your mind works. There's a lot about how we know a lot about how our bodies work, thanks to science. We know a lot about how the psyche works, thanks to science. But the chittas, when you take them individually, this is the science of the chitta. The science of the chitta and the science of the mind can sometimes be worlds apart. Psychologists, they explain to us through empirical science, trial and error, human behaviors. But here we understand the root cause behind those behaviors. Psychology ultimately is the study of human behavior, how the mind operates in certain circumstances, in certain situations, in certain environments. But then there will be certain questions when you ask of psychology, they'll have to say, well, that's just because that's the way it is. But once you start to delve into how the mind works at this level, this is kind of like the atomic level of how the mind works, then a lot of the questions that you had, a lot of the answers that you wanted, a lot of the problems that you needed solutions to, they begin to surface. So ultimately, our quest here is to try and understand why we do the things we do, why we feel the things we feel, why we sometimes struggle to rationalize some of the things that we do, we think, we say, and of course you know what comes afterwards. Things like regret, remorse, repentance. You know, it's just like us creating a prison for ourselves and locking ourselves in there. So if we can figure out why we do the things we do, why we feel the way we feel, why we say some of the things we say, and how we can bring the best of ourselves out in every situation, that level of understanding elevates your life. Not just a day, not just a moment, it elevates your life entirely. It helps you to live a more fulfilling life. A life where you have no regrets. Most people die with plenty of them, don't they? Most people die with plenty of regrets. Most people die wishing that they'd lived a different life. Most people die wishing that they had another day to fix the errors of their ways. Most people are like that, unfortunately. So it's not the years that you've lived that matters. It's the depth with which you have lived them. So that is what we are here for. To actually add meaning to our lives and live full lives. You know, we've all been given a fantastic chance to do something meaningful with our lives, to make a difference in this world, haven't we? To make a difference in the people's lives that we come into contact with, the people's lives we get to touch. You are so fortunate to be in such situations. In here, there'll be mothers who can make an influence on their children and actually make a meaningful impact, not just on today, but on the future of the world. There are fathers here who can make a difference in an entire family. There are teachers here who get to influence and make changes in people's lives, and so that they can go on to be a change to the entire country, to the nation, to the whole world. So when you have such influence, when you have such influential power, it's important that you have the right knowledge. What the Buddha's teaching does is it empowers you by giving you the right knowledge and to actually help you find ultimate bliss. So let's embark on another step, one step forward today, to try and find some answers to the riddles that have kept us behind this veil of darkness, such that we can come out of it wise, intelligent, and enlightened, and live full and happy lives. So before we do that, let us all bring our palms together in veneration of He who is the source of all of this, of He who started all of this. Fortunately for us, we have a teacher, but he had none. He had to discover this path all by himself. He had to walk the path all by himself, and he had to achieve it and then go on to preach it and teach it to others all by himself. It is to his holy name we make this veneration. He is the supremely enlightened one, the perfect one, the infinitely compassionate one, the supreme Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Before we get started, actually, there's something really important that I thought I should share with you. I've got to say, I've been in two thoughts about this. I've been debating with myself whether I say this or not, but ultimately, I thought, better said than not said. And the reason for my, at least momentary, hesitation is because, as with anything, ladies and gentlemen, there'll always be people who will come and go, either to the talks in person or people watching online, of various and different mentalities. And that's perfectly fine. You'll have people from all walks of life. That is absolutely fine. Because the Buddha's asana is for whom? For all, isn't it? But at the same time, there'll be people who will have various opinions about things. And I don't know if you remember that the notice or the board that we have outside, it says quite clearly, you have to be open-minded. If you want to come along, in fact, not really if you want to come along, but rather, for these talks to actually begin to have an impact on your lives, I expect a certain degree of open-mindedness. And here's what I mean by that. What I mean by open-mindedness is the willingness to do a few things. Number one, be prepared to accept that everything and anything that you hold as true today might be wrong. Might be. Not is, might be. So, if you are someone who is very adamant and you're not willing to budge, you're not prepared to change your opinion on something, then I don't see how people like that could actually attain Nibbana. The reason for my hesitation again is, I don't want you to take this in the wrong way. I want you to take this in the spirit that I mean it. You know the compassion with which the Mahasangha always wishes to help you. Right? So please, the very first thing I'll say is, if you feel the slightest bit offended by what I'm saying, then be rest assured that that is not my intention. Let's start with that. Okay? Even the slightest bit. If you're the slightest bit offended by what I'm saying and what I'm about to say, then be assured that you got it the wrong way. It was not meant to be so. And that's always possible, right? Someone says, I like you, you think they said they love you. And the next thing you know, you're on your knees begging for their hand in marriage. They just know, I just said I like you. So, in almost the same way, if you're the slightest bit offended by what I'm about to say, then please be assured that you got it the wrong way and that was not my intention. I don't mean to offend anyone. Because here's the thing, this is the reason why I don't want to offend anyone. It's not just because it's not good to offend anyone. You know, you've got to be polite with people, you have to be nice with people, and offending people is not good. In civil society, we don't do that. We are very respectful and courteous and all that. That's not the main reason why I don't want to come across as offensive. The main reason why I don't want to come across as offensive is, if you feel the slightest bit offended, then you lose the joy of that is required in your heart, in your mind, the prasada, citta, that you require to understand the Dhamma. If you don't have that joy in your heart, as you listen to a sermon, as you contemplate on the Dhamma, if you don't have that joy, that bliss that comes with the fact that, you know, when you're happy, when you're blissful, when you're joyful, if you don't have that, it's almost impossible to give you the Dhamma in that moment. You know, maybe a minute later, you're okay, and then it's fine again. But remember, you know, I'm not preaching to you as a human being, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you must know that by now. These words are not meant for people. These words are meant for chittas. Although you think you're a person, you are not really. You're a mind and a body. And if your chitta is not in a state of prasada, it is a state of joy. It's akin to trying to fill a pot up when you have the pot turned upside down. So there will be no point whatsoever in me trying to put all the water in the world and fill you up once the pot is turned upside down. So, as monks, when we preach the Dhamma, we are very careful. We try to be very, very careful to not offend anyone and to not make anyone feel hurt when we deliver a sermon. For the only reason that if you feel that way, then it becomes incredibly difficult for you to understand the Dhamma. So coming back to the point I was trying to get across. Are we all agreed on that page? If ever you feel the slightest bit offended by what I'm about to say, you got it the wrong way. Okay? Not my fault now, right? You just got it the wrong way. That's not how I meant it. I'm only saying this to you because I need you, I want you, I really, really, really want you to make the most of the time that you spend here. Even if you're not here and you're watching the talks online, right? Sometimes, you know, I know that there are many of you who, although you come to the talks here, you also go back and watch the sermons again and again, sometimes, on, you know, several times, just to make sure that you really grasped the full essence of the talk. And really, hats off to those of you who've got the time to do that, and also those who actually do that. Now, that's really wonderful, the fact that you do that. I sometimes listen to the talk again, the talk that I've done. And there's a reason for that. This is not my Dhamma. This Dhamma does not belong to me. Do you remember last week or the week before I thanked you? During the talk I said, I'm really enjoying this talk and thank you. Do you remember that? I thanked you because we have created an environment that was conducive for that Dhamma to arise. It is not my doing entirely. I'm only one of the causes. My practicing the Dhamma, my virtues, the way in which I contemplate on the Dhamma, my teachers, right? The precepts that I observe and my adherence to them, you know, all of these things are just a few of the causes. But you know, each and every one of you individually are also causes. So whatever Dhamma we come across in a sitting, in a session, it's a manifestation, just like anything. I mean, if this is a manifestation, then the Dhamma talk is also a manifestation. It would be wrong for me to take full credit for it. Not even the Buddha takes full credit for anything. The Buddha preaches one sermon in the presence of the Panchavagya Bhikkhus. He preaches another sermon in the presence of the Yasa, of Yasa and his friends. So these are all manifestations. All things in this world are manifestations. This is why I thanked you last week, because I really enjoyed that talk, and what I figured was, you know, what a fantastic audience, because had it not been partly at least for the audience, that sort of talk would not have come out. Sometimes I you know, in the middle of the talk, I realized, wow, that's such a profound statement. You know, I don't take credit for that. Honestly. So I'm never going to expect you to write down what I've said and then put my name next to it. Say, this is by so-and-so, because it is not by me. If anyone deserves credit for it, it is the Buddha. But this side of that, it's whatever the causes were that were present in that moment to manifest that effect, after all. So I know that you do spend time going over these talks, sometimes on several times over, and you do spend some time on the internet, on YouTube and so on. But then just like people will come here in person, there will be those who watch the sermons online, and they will be of various opinions. And are they not entitled to their opinion? Absolutely. Everyone is entitled to their opinion. And that's fine. And I'm not even saying that it's a must that people are open-minded. They needn't be. But here's the thing. Let's be honest. So far, all the opinions we've had in our lives, all the things that we've held as true in our lives, have not got us anywhere near Nibbana, have they? I mean, so far. You know, how old are you now? You are full of opinions. You have an opinion about everything. Once again, you're entitled to them, right? We all have opinions. I have opinions. You have opinions. We all have opinions about things. And we're entitled to our opinions. That's fair and square. But all of the opinions that we've had about all sorts of things have gotten us nowhere near Nibbana. That's why to this day, those opinions, you still have them, but you still suffer. What the Buddhas taught, what the Buddhas have come and taught us, ladies and gentlemen, are not their opinions. Let's get that straight. The Buddha doesn't come into this world to share with us his opinion. He gives us fact. That's why once the Buddha delivers the first discourse, he says, in a world of devas and maras and humans, there is none who can undo what I have done. That is turning the wheel of the Dhamma. As soon as he utters the Dhamma Chakkappavattana Sutta, he makes his proclamation. There is none who can undo this. There is none who can say that what I have said is wrong. Not even another Buddha. Not even himself. Because he does not come into this world to give his opinion. The Buddha is the truth. The truth is the truth. It's no one's opinion. You can bear the truth as your opinion, but that's not just an opinion, that's the truth. So, from time to time, you will have individuals who will come here, who you will meet online, right? They will have their own opinions and they are perfectly entitled to have their opinions. But if they're not open-minded, in other words, if they're not willing to change their opinions in the presence of fact, where their opinions are challenged and it's proven to them that what they hold is true, may be wrong, and therefore willing to take on another piece of information to from henceforth hold as true. If they're not willing to do that, in other words, basically they're adamant. That's okay. But the point is, not in a million years will they get to Nibbana. Do you not agree with me on that point? If, you know, just go back a few months before we started doing all this. Go back a few years for some of you who've been listening to the talks at the monastery, some of you have been listening online, whatever, right? Let's go back a few years. You held a certain view of the world, didn't you? Last week we talked about beauty. I'm just taking a simple example. Last week we talked about beauty and how the beauty is merely an illusion of the mind. Wasn't there a point in your lives, ladies and gentlemen, where when you saw something that you thought was beautiful, a rose for instance, you firmly held the belief that beauty is in the rose. It is the rose that brings you beauty. Were we not of that opinion? But was it fact? Was it fact? No. But how about if you'd been adamant about that? Let's say last week I go through the examples, I show you how not everyone finds a rose beautiful. Some find a lily beautiful, others find a rose beautiful. Right? Not everyone's favorite flower is a rose. And not everyone thinks a rose is fragrant. Some find it, some find it isn't. Now today we are going to go over several more examples. That's why you all have a different favorite food. That's why you all have a different favorite color. That's why you all have a different favorite song. Right? These are all very personal things, aren't they? They're very subjective. But let's just say you were of the opinion that beauty is in the object. And then you were adamant about it and not willing to change your opinion about that. How on earth am I going to get you to Nibbana? Because to get to Nibbana, you need to first understand that beauty is not in the object out there. It is a creation of the mind when the mind goes into vexation. And I'm showing to you, proving to you with facts and figures and the data and your experience. And I always ask you to go into your lab of life so you can test all of the things that I share with you. But let's just say there's someone in the audience, either here or online, who says, No. I'm not interested in what Swami Mahansa has to say. Beauty is in the flower, right? I don't care what he says, but beauty is in the flower. My question is, why do you come here? I mean, you're wasting petrol. You're wasting your time. This is time you could have spent with your family. This is time you could have gone and earned some money for yourself, you know, and made a contribution to the nation. Why come here? I'm not just a Dhamma talk. I suggest, you know, whenever you go to any talk, just about any talk, You're going to a talk because you want to hear someone else's opinion about something, don't you? You want to take on someone else's perspective on something. And then that's not saying you've got to completely discard everything you held as true and then accept entirely what they're saying verbatim. Right? That's not what I mean by that. Even the Buddha speaks against that. He says, just because it's in the books, just because it's passed down generation to generation, just because your teacher says so, just because it's logical, even so, you must not accept it. Take it, apply it, see whether it brings you results, and then accept it. But you see, if that is the Buddha's method to test whether something's right or wrong, then I think we should admit that the Buddha knows. So if the Buddha knows, if you are adamant about something and not willing to try out things and test things out in the ways in which that he has advised we do, we're not going to move anywhere. We're not going to move forward. We're just going to be in the same place and rot. So there will be individuals, and there may be some in the audience today, there will always be some in the audience. In any audience, there will always be some. There will be some online. There will be some you've not met yet, but they're on their way. And are they not entitled to their opinion once again? They are perfectly entitled to their opinion. I will fight for the right for them to hold their opinion. I will fight for that. If there's someone who says, you know, they're not entitled to their opinion, I will speak against it, even if they hold the wrong opinion. Even if their opinion does not reflect fact, they're entitled to their right and I will speak up on their behalf. So that's not the point here. But the point is, if you want to get to Nibbana, if you want to get to a destination you've never been to before, if you want to embark on a journey you've never been on before, you're going to take a different path, one that you've never treaded on before, then of course you're going to have to take a new set of directions. Yes or no? Yes. So then, if you are fixed in your opinions, if you're adamant that this is true and nothing else can be true, my tuppence worth would be, then just hold what you believe is true and stay at home. Because Nibbana is not going to work for you. Unless, of course, you have already arrived at Nibbana, in which case, again, be at home. This is not the place for those who have attained to Nibbana. This is the place for those who are aspiring to Nibbana. Now, here's what could happen when we have individuals like that. They might come and speak with you. They'll come and talk to you. They might come and speak to you maybe at the end of the sermon, and maybe while they're having the sandwich that you brought them. Right, they'll come and have a chat with you. And you know, remember, the internet is the wild, wild west. That's why they call it WWW. Right? In the wild, wild west, you don't know what's going on. You know, everyone's there on the internet. Right? They don't vet you before they get you on the internet, right? Everyone has an opinion, and once you're online, you can voice your opinion. And the whole world gets to see that. Remember, words are very influential. What's mightier than the sword? Exactly. So you've got to be very careful who you allow to influence you. By being here, folks, you have given me a vote of confidence. Your presence here is a vote of trust. Let's be honest. And I want it to be that way, and forever it should be that way. You didn't decide to be a regular, at least until you'd listened to a few sermons. Either you came along to the first sermon, you thought, okay, let's try another one. You came to the second sermon, you thought, it seems like he knows what he's talking about. Some things I don't quite agree with, but okay, let's try another week. Besides, we get some free sandwiches at the end, so why not? So you came a third week, you came a fourth week, you know, by about the fifth and the sixth week, you begin to realize, here's what happens. You start to apply what you pick up from here. That's what starts to happen a few weeks into this process. Because you know what? You can't not apply it. What you understand, right? How can you not understand something? Because it's not something that you do. It is something that is done. Right? I tell you, this is a vatapata. If I'm making rhyme and reason, if I'm making logic, how can you now walk away not having understood that? Yeah? Two and two is? Try and not understand that. You can't do that. Yeah? So after a few weeks of you listening to these things attentively and you're, you know, toing and froing and debating with yourself, you know, there are opinions that you bring here, but then you analyze them, you reflect on them, and especially the first few weeks, I said, you know, whatever opinions you have, whatever understanding you have of the Dhamma, just leave it out there as you walk into the room, but don't you worry, it's always going to be there as you walk out, right? We've informed the janitors not to clean that until you have left. Right, so the carpets don't get dusted until you have left. So whatever opinions you walk in with, you can walk out with them. But while you're here, be open-minded. But what you will have is, you will have some individuals who will come and go. Sometimes, you know, they'll just come because they've got nothing better to do on a Sunday morning. But, you know, let's welcome them as well. We're always welcoming. And who knows? Like, who knows when the penny might drop for them? Who knows if today is a good day for them? Who knows? That's why it's not right for us to block anyone from coming in here. That's not right. Even if we have a murderer walking in through these gates, right? They're also, if we should offer them a seat and make sure they're comfortable, show them the washrooms, ask them if they'd like a drink, right? Make sure that they're comfortable. Let me tell you this, folks. Matters not who walks in through these gates. It may be that they're walking in today to the sermon to actually come and shoot Swami Nansi. They've got a gun. Because they don't like Swami Nansi for whatever reason. You will not know this. What if they walk in with a gun, but they have the merits to become a sotapanna? All they need to hear are a few words, and they're not planning on putting the gun out until the end of the sermon. So, let them sit in the sermon. Because this sermon just might be the day, just might be the sermon where they drop their weapons, not for just for today, but forever. Angulimalas have been in this sasana, and they've been evidence of that. Remember, we are not speaking to people, we are speaking to chittas. One chitta can make a big difference. One chitta. How do you know whether the next person walking in through these doors has the most amount of merits? Maybe they're a Muslim. Maybe they're a Christian. Maybe they're a devout Hindu. They're all looking for happiness. They're all looking for the answers to the riddles of life. So they walk in through these doors. They sit down right at the back. They're not interested in coming to the front. They sit down right at the back. And maybe they sit down right at the back and they're just, you know, browsing their Facebook, you know, tapping away on sending some messages. That's what they're here for. They're not really keen on listening to the Dhamma, but their ears are doing what they've got to do. And Swami Nansi starts talking about the Dhamma. They think, oh, something sounds interesting. Let's see what he has to say. They look at it critically. They don't want to accept what I'm about to say. So they're looking for errors in my explanation. Is that such a bad thing to do? No. There will be people who will come along, either here or they'll listen to the talks online. Their sole intention, unlike yours, their sole intention is to find out all the wrong things that Swami Nansi is saying. Every point that he gets wrong, they note it down. That's what they're there for. We've had people like that. You know, when we first started to deliver the Dhamma, right, my teacher included, mainly Guru Hamdro, when he first started to preach the Dhamma, there were many who didn't like the style, there were many who didn't like the doctrine, there were many who were quite against it. Because we were delivering the Dhamma in a way that none had heard before. And people's lives began to change. And this had an impact on other establishments, let's just say. Some establishments were affected. And some establishments where they had, let's say, devotees who were very devoted to them, they were looking for answers themselves. So they'd go every poya day, observe seal, they'd go for the sermons, but what they hadn't discovered was a solution to the problems in their lives. But they would observe the precepts, they would listen to the bodhisattva tales, they would listen to the jataka tales, and you know, that was part of what being a Buddhist was for them. But they didn't find the answers to the riddles of life. They didn't find answers to the problems we put on the board a couple of weeks ago. And then once we started to deal with the Dhamma, people's lives started to change. Just ask yourself, why is it you're coming to these talks? You know, is this the first time you've heard a Swaminathan give a Dhamma talk? For, you know, you've been around for so long, in almost every temple in the country, right? If you go in on a poya day, if you go in on a Sunday, if you go in on a Saturday, there'll be some sort of program going on, right? You can go and attend them, you can go and listen to them. Besides, online, how many Dhamma talks can you find online? Almost every other video you bump into is going to be a Dhamma talk of some sort. But why are you here? I can't speak on behalf of everyone, but here's what I can say about you. You've discovered that there is some essence in this which you may not have come across before in your life. Not because it's me delivering the Dhamma, it's because the Dhamma has begun to make a change in your lives. That is the acid test. The Buddha was asked this question, I've said it to you before, Venerable Sir, how do we know that what people preach, monks they preach, the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, they're all around the country, they preach. How do we know that what they preach is what you have said, what you have said? How do we know that this is the Buddha's word? And the Buddha's answer was, as you listen to those talks, if you feel the fire of raga, the fire of dvesha, and the fire of moha extinguishing within yourself, if you begin to feel liberation, if you begin to feel that the 11 great fires that have kept tormenting you, these fires, they're burning out, then come to the realization that you are listening to the word of the Mahasamana. You are listening to the words of the Buddha. This was the Buddha's yardstick to measure for ourselves whether the words that we come across, the words we are listening to, the Dhamma that we listen to, are actually the words of the Buddha. So this has been happening for people, and there were those who didn't like that because their way of living was affected. You know, this is not just today. When the Buddha first started preaching the Dhamma, do you know how many death threats he got? So far, I've got none. I don't know whether I'm asking for trouble here. Personally, I've had none so far. But the Buddha, I mean, thankfully he was the Buddha. You can't kill a Buddha. It's impossible. You can't murder a Buddha. And that is how it is. Because, you know, a Buddha is a Buddha. He's a supreme Buddha. He's not like anyone else. He's unequal. Right? It is the paramitas that produce a Buddha. Many millions of years of paramitas that produce a Buddha. Something so sublime, something so wonderful, something so, such a gift to all humanity cannot simply be destroyed by stabbing with a knife. It doesn't work like that. You can kill an arahant, but you can't kill a Buddha. Even in the five heinous sins, you have killing the mother, killing the father, schism in the Sangha, right? You have hurting or shaking the blood of the Buddha. You have killing an arahant, but you don't have killing a Buddha because it cannot be done. A Buddha passes into parinibbana when he's ready for it. How's that for size? He passes into parinibbana when he feels he's ready for it. That's why 3 full moons before his passing away, he makes a determination, in 3 full moons time, I will pass into parinibbana. And once it is said, it is said. Such are the words of a Buddha. Once it's said, no changes. You know how Venerable Ananda comes up to him and says, Oh, Venerable Sir, you know what a great omission I've made. on that occasion I should have asked you, but the Mara had deluded my mind. I was lost in my thoughts. I got carried away. I forgot to ask you, to invite you to stay on for another kalpa. Because back in those days, you could live unto 120 years. That was the lifespan of a human being. But the Buddha passed away at just 80. So had Venerable Ananda invited him, he would have been able to stay on till 120. Don't ask me how. Don't ask me anything about the Buddha, really. Because he's unequaled. He's incomparable. My little pea brain of cannot explain the things that a Buddha can and cannot do. He's not omnipotent, but he's omniscient. He understands it all. He knows it all. But what the Buddha can and cannot do, don't ask me. And don't ask me why he can do those things and how he can do those things, how he can perform the twin miracle. I don't know. Ask the Buddha. I'm just a servant of the Buddha. So anyhow, back then there were plenty of threats because, you know, there were many religious leaders at the time. And these religious leaders, they were self-proclaimed religious leaders. Some of them. They went on to become religious leaders because of the fame, the glory that it brought it. You know, it used to be a thing back then to have a bunch of followers. You know, like these days, sensuality is a big thing, right? Going online, you know, just enjoying, partying. These things are a big thing today. Back then, that was not what people were interested in. You know, this was the time where people were thinkers. Just think about it. People were thinkers. They were philosophers. There was an era back then. Some call it the Axial Age. So you have the Stone Age, right? That was called, referred to as the Axial Age. Back then, you know, these were the time where the philosophers came in. The likes of Socrates and, you know, these people, they came into this world all around the same time. So back then, it was quite common to have people who would go around. Sometimes they would be stationary, sometimes they would travel the lands with their students and followers. And the number of students that they had was a representation of their power and their authority. So that brought them a lot of fame and a lot of glory, a lot of respect. Now just imagine, when you have a society that is based on the number of followers you have is a measure of how successful you are. Today, the size of your house, the size of your car, right, these are the things that are a measure of how successful you are. The size of your bank account today is one of the measures, one of the most important measures, the KPIs, yeah, one of the KPIs of how successful you are. But back then, it was not that. Having all the money did not make you necessarily successful. Wealth was not the only measure back then. Back then, people were philosophers. I'm talking about the time when the Buddha came into this world. Not forever, right? Not always. It wasn't always like that, but around that time. So just imagine, there were a lot of people who had a bunch of followers, and the number of followers that they had, like you have on Facebook today. Yeah? When you go on Facebook, what is your cred? You have street cred, you have Facebook cred. Right? Your cred is how many followers you have, how many likes you have, how many friends you have. There was a time like that. The number of followers you had was a mark of your power, your authority. Now just imagine, the Buddha comes along. He starts off with 5 people. He preaches the Dhamma. Thanks to their merits, they understand the Dhamma. And then they realize, we've never heard something like this before. At the end of these talks, most people say, it seems like our lives have been turned inside out, upside down, the right side up. They say that. This is a paean of joy that they utter at the point of hearing the Dhamma. You know, because people are always looking for answers to suffering. That's all. I've often asked you, why do you do the things you do? And we always have unanimously a single answer, don't we? We can do this survey every day of the year. But you'll all come back with the same answer. You do different things, but you do it all with the same purpose. And that one purpose is happiness. Even back then, People did the same. People did so many different things, but all in the name of happiness. So there were those who were yogis. There were those who were ascetics. Siddhartha saw one of them, didn't he? When he had one of the four sights that influenced him and inspired him to renounce his worldly life, one of the sights he saw was an ascetic. So there were hermits back then, there were ascetics back then, there were yogis back then, there were Brahmins back then, there were many philosophers back then. And they went around preaching whatever doctrine they thought was true. There were those who preached a philosophy of the Brahmas. And they said the Mahabrahma is the supreme being and it's our goal, it's our aspiration to somehow try and unite with the Mahabrahma. Somewhere like that. Then there were some who said, you know, there is no such thing called life after death. So all we've got to do is try and enjoy ourselves to the fullest as we can. And then, you know, that was some people's philosophy. Then there were some who believed in nihilism. There is nothing. Nothing exists. All that you see are merely, it's just a facade. Nothing exists really. This is a lie. We all live in a lie. Nothing exists. So there was nothing before this and there's nothing going to be after this. Even the present is nothing. There were some like that, and there were teachers and there were students and followers who subscribed to that school of thought. Today, things are a little bit more regulated than that. Like at schools, you have to teach the national curriculum, don't you? In the temples, you have to preach by at least the Tripitaka. Right? I mean, you can make your own interpretations out of it, but when questioned, anyone in vain should be able to point it out. Here's in the Tripitaka how it appears and so on. In universities, they have a curriculum to which they teach and it's all standardized, right? And there's a convention and there's a world convention that everyone agrees on. But back then, it was not so. If even if you were there back then, you had an opinion about something, all you had to do was get onto a mountain cliff and start preaching and people would come and listen to you because people are looking for answers. And if you made just a modicum of sense, at the end of that talk, you'd have a bunch of followers. Some would give up their worldly lives, some would give up their wives, some would give up their children, and they'd join you. So this was rife back then. So they felt threatened by what the Buddha had come in to do. Because people's livelihood was affected. I'll say that again. People's livelihood was affected. There were many who relied on charity, on the charity of those who thought that their philosophy was true. Now just think about it. The Buddha comes and preaches. He walks around, you know, goes from town to town, village to village, he preaches. Right? People just go up and listen to what he has to say. At the end of that talk, a bunch of people, all the villages for that matter, say, my gosh, we've never heard something like this before. This is the truth. This is the ultimate bliss that we've been looking for. And then what do? They give up their existing teacher. They give up on their teacher. And then they go and say, Venerable Sir, please ordain us. Please take us into the sasana. So the next thing you know, those teachers, they come back and they look for their students and they're all gone with the Buddha. So every time the Buddha would go into one village or another, following him were many young people, people who had been looking for the truth, people who had discovered the truth, and you know, they would leave their lives and go with the Buddha. These were people who had come in samsara looking for the answers with plenty of paramita and lots of merit. So it was like a flower waiting to blossom. The moment you have a bit of sunlight fall on it, the flower blossoms, and that's what happened back then. But then, these philosophers who were there back then, they didn't like this. They felt threatened. Their livelihood was threatened. Because they were reliant on the charity of wealthy, rich people. So, put two and two together. Is it not obvious then why the Buddha received many death threats? So even we have people to this day who don't like what we do. There'll be those who might criticize the Dhamma that I preach. You will find many, a dime a dozen. Just go online Every other video clip you find, if you just type in the name of our monastery, and every other video clip you'll find is one that will say, these people, they're just distorting the Dhamma. They're cooking up all sorts of lies. This is not the truth. When did the Buddha ever preach something like this? You will have that. But if you can find one video of us going back to them with answers and trying to justify ourselves, we don't do that. Because that's not what we're here for. We haven't got the time for that. We are here for you. Not to answer to every question that is a challenge to us. If you want the Nibbana, then we have Nibbana to offer to you. If you're not interested in Nibbana, if you want a debate, then go debate. This is not a debating house. Once again, if any of you feel offended, what did I say right at the beginning? That is not my intention. You have taken it the wrong way. Okay? So this is not me criticizing or trying to offend anyone. That's why I said right at the beginning, everyone is entitled to their opinion, and that's perfectly fine. This is a free country, right? We can think what we like, we can follow what we like, we can, you know, have our own religion, we can say what we like, right? This is a free country. But as far as Nibbana is concerned, there can't be two truths. There can only be one truth. There are infinite lies, but there's only one truth. So my advice to you would be, if you are serious about your Nibbana, and you know that so far you've done all sorts of things, you've tried various schools, you've tried various philosophies, you've tried various practices, and none of them have really got you freedom. None of them have really got you any closer to happiness, unconditional happiness. And you've always been trialing and erroring and trying that over and over again, right? Just be mindful that you're playing with your own time here. You're playing with your own time. It's okay to hear what someone might have to say, but don't let people influence you just willy-nilly. I'm not saying this on anyone's behalf other than yours. So even if you go online, there will be those who will come and comment about things. There will be those who will say, you know, those who go to these talks are idiots. I don't know whether there's a comment like that yet, but if there isn't one, I can tell you that there will be one soon enough. Maybe someone might hear this and go, yeah, absolutely, Swaminas, you're well done. Those who go to these talks are idiots. And you know, we haven't got the time to go and sanitize YouTube. We put it there for the benefit of the masses. Would you rather me be spending my time, ladies and gentlemen, practicing the path, practicing what I preach, contemplating the Dhamma, so that the next time we meet next week, I've got something a little bit more to add to your lives and help you get to your destination sooner rather than later? Or would you rather me have me sit down behind YouTube and, you know, check every comment there is, and, you know, remove the ones that don't agree with what I have to say, and, you know, remove the naysayers, remove the criticizers, right? Would you rather have me do that? Or shall we just let them do what they have to do and we do what we have to do? Because we are not here for popularity. That's not what we're here for. We are not here for a fan base. We are not here for the subscribers. We are here for Nibbana. And nothing more. We're only here for Nibbana. If you want it, come and get it. If you don't want it, come and get it when you want it. Because everyone will one day attain to Nibbana. One day. That one day does not have to be today. Does it? Who says? It's not a law. There's no rule. You have to attain Nibbana or else. No. Not all Buddhists have to attain Nibbana. No, 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 no. So when you find yourselves, you know, bumping into such comments, right, stumbling on those comments and so on, don't you get dragged into those conversations. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your time in ways that I wouldn't waste mine. Write that down in case you forget. Don't waste your time in ways that I wouldn't mine. So if you see comments, you know, be that on Facebook, I don't know where else these sermons go, because, you know, we just put it on, I think, as far as I know, YouTube, but then people take these things, download them, they share it on other platforms and so on. Right? Maybe tomorrow we'll start promoting it on some other platform. We just want to get the word out to people, because that's what the Buddha asked us to do. Charita bhikkhave, charikam bahujana hitaya bahujana sukhaya. That's what the Buddha asked us to do. We are following the Buddha's advice to the letter. He wanted us to do this. If he said, monks, all you've got to do is practice the Dhamma, sit to a side, the devotees will come and make your offerings, you have them, and just you know, sit in meditation and just do that, then we wouldn't have gone around preaching. But the Buddha asked us to do this. As his servants, we must follow his advice. He wanted us to go from town to town, from village to village, preaching the Dhamma. Today, we have the internet for that. So my little legs don't have to break in the process of trying to carry the Dhamma. The internet does that on our behalf. So when you go online, you find these comments, right? Wherever they might appear. Not just these talks, I mean any talk for that matter. Not just from this Swaminuhanse or from our monastery, any Swaminuhanse, any talk for that matter, right? If you say stumble on a Dhamma talk and they are talking about a Dhamma, their perspective on the Dhamma, and that is completely different to what we are talking about here. Okay? Don't you be the one who goes on there and start commenting and saying, what is this? This is rubbish. This is nonsense. How can someone attain Nibbana this way? That's not your place to say that. If it doesn't work for you, get up and leave. That's all. I mean, you know, if you go to a restaurant and the food isn't nice, you have a right to complain because you're paying for it. How much have you paid for a Dhamma sermon? Huh? So what right do you have to complain? If it doesn't work for you, what have you got to do? Get up and leave. Click on another one. There's plenty of fish in the sea. Just click on another one. All I'm saying is, I don't want you getting engaged in all that riffraff. Don't get involved in all that nonsense. You know how much I care about your valuable life. I mean, so many times I've spoken about this, right? How we must be heedful and how we must be earnest in our practice. Time is of the essence here, ladies and gentlemen. It is all you have and it is all you don't have. Both at the same time. It's funny, one of these, you know, time is a funny thing. It's all you have and it's all you don't have. So don't be messing around with your time. If you think there's a Dhamma talk on there, it doesn't agree with your principles, doesn't agree with your values, right? Or maybe, you know, there's a monk who says he's a, or monk or a nun, whoever, who says he's a Rahat Hanumanse. Right? But then you don't agree with their conduct. Don't you be the ones who starts commenting, say, how can a Rahat Hanumanse be like this? I don't think this is a Rahat Hanumanse. You know, you're just trying to instigate a conflict. Why? If someone believes that is an actual Rahat Hanumanse, and, you know, they have nothing but joy because they believe that's a Rahat Hanumanse. And because of that joy, they go on to make offerings to that Rahat Hanumanse. Remember, the merit is not in the offering. Merit is in the thought. It's in the intention. So even if you offer something, and I'm an unvirtuous person, I'm just, you know, just a wolf dressed in a sheep's coat. If in your mind you are making that offering to the Mahasangha, that's why I always remind you, don't make individual offerings, make an offering to the Mahasangha. When you make an offering to the Mahasangha, it matters not whether this is a sheep or a wolf. Matters not. Whether I'm virtuous or unvirtuous, it makes no difference to you. Because in your mind you are making that offering to the Mahasangha, and the Mahasangha is always sublime. Always. They're always pristine. They're always perfect. We aspire to the Mahasangha. So therefore, even if someone pretends to be an arahant, and they're the worst kind of human being you would ever have come across, matters not if they are there saying, I'm the Mahasangha. And you have a chance now to offer something because you believe you're making that offering to the Mahasangha. And someone's doing that, let them. Don't spoil it for them. Because they're earning plenty of merits out of doing that. But someone who's consuming it when they're not entitled to it, of course, you know, that's their doing, isn't it? They might be earning lots of demerit by fooling people, by making claims when that they are not what they are. I mean, the Buddha has laid that down as a parajika even. It's an offense that expels you from the sasana. If you claim to have a margapala, which you don't, and you do it with the intention of deceiting, sometimes you could be fooled. Sometimes you might think you actually have achieved that, and then you make a claim. That's not a problem. You actually believe. Let's say I actually believe I'm a Rahatan Mahansa, and then I say I'm a Rahatan Mahansa. Nothing wrong with that. If I actually believe that, even if I'm wrong, but I personally believe that it's true. In that case, that is not a parajika. But if I do it with the intention of deceiving, so that those who listen to these words will come and make their offerings to me, so that I can benefit from the sasana, now that is an offense that leads to expulsion from the sasana. But how are we to check whether they are actual Rahatan Mahantes or not? Who's given us the right to do that? Only a Buddha can check that. So that's not our place to do that. All we've got to do is, if someone says they're a Rahatan Mahantes, just bring your hands together and say, Sadhu, Sadhu. That's all. Whether you listen to their sermons, their talks, their preachings or not is another matter. Just because someone says they're a Rahatan Mahantes doesn't mean that's where you got to get your Dhamma from. No. See, there's a Rahatan Mahantes, he only speaks Spanish. How many people in this audience can go and listen to him and actually understand Nibbana? Hardly any. So just because someone's a Rahatan Mahantes doesn't mean that should be your source of Dhamma. Because like I said, the Buddha gives us the yardstick to check whether the Dhamma that you're listening to is the Dhamma that's going to get you across the ocean of samsara. Raga ke, dvesha ke, moha ke. If these three things are happening within you as you listen to the Dhamma, that is the word of the Mahasamana. That is the word of the Buddha. So no matter who preaches the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen, whether it's a lay individual, whether it's a monk, whether it's a nun, right? Or even if a deva comes from the heavenly worlds and they start preaching the Dhamma, listen to it attentively, open-mindedly, but listen to it carefully. See whether raga ke, dvesha ke, moha ke is happening within you. There's a lovely saying in Sinhalese, allow me to quote that. Asanna, no. Kiyanna kese kiwad, asanna sihibuddhiyang asiyutu. You heard that, right? It matters not how someone says something. What matters more importantly is how you listen to it. That is the most important thing. That is the key to realization. So don't you get embroiled in all that commenting, toing and froing, right? So you'll find plenty of people who will come and make their own comments. They'll say that this Dhamma is distorted. They'll say that this Dhamma is a lie, that these monks, they're not virtuous. You know, they only come up here and pretend to be very virtuous, but back at the monastery, they're with women and all sorts. You'll get all sorts. That's okay. Don't go and challenge them because you're wasting your time. Whatever you sow, you shall reap. So whatever they sow, they shall reap. If done with good intention, then they will reap with good intention. If done with bad intention, then they will reap accordingly. Your task is none of that. You are here exclusively for Nibbana. Don't let anything sidetrack you. you have had enough and more diversions in your life, right, that have thrown you off the course of your purpose of existence. Today, I've had to remind you that the reason you were born was to attain Nibbana. That's how much life distracted you. Don't you agree with me? Today, I'm having to remind you. The Mahasangha is having to remind you that the very reason you were born, human beings, was to attain Nibbana. I'm having to remind you. Because there are plenty and more distractions. There are many diversions. Every other newspaper you pick up, every other TV channel you watch, every other program you come across, every other thing you see on a mobile phone is a distraction, it's a diversion. It takes you, pulls you out ruthlessly from your path of salvation. You know, getting to Nibbana is hard enough without all those distractions. Until you started listening to the Dhamma, it didn't matter to you, right, what people had to say about us? Yeah? Until you started to listen to this Swami Nuhansa, or come to the monastery, and you know, come to Jetavanarama monastery, and listen to what Guru Hanudal had to say, I had to say, our Swami Nuhansa had to say, it didn't matter to you what people said about us. Why now? Let it not. Otherwise, your newfound interest in the Dhamma is going to be the very reason you're going to get out of it. So these are words of caution, all given with love and compassion, because I don't want you to sidestep, to sidetrack and get distracted. Living a lay life and trying to attain Nibbana is hard enough. Anyone disagree? Put your hand up. I've been ordained for the last 6 years, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm yet to become an arahant. You see how tough this is? I've been ordained for the last 6 years. I've been listening to the Dhamma, the pristine Dhamma, for at least the last 10, 15 years. And I'm yet to get to my destination. How tough do you think it's going to be for you lay people? Once again, please don't be offended. I speak with love only. So don't let any of these distractions throw you off track. Let them come and go. They'll do what they have to do. You're here for something else. Be focused. Have laser sharp focus on your salvation. Do your merits. Practice kusal. Listen to the Dhamma. Contemplate on the Dhamma. And work your way one step at a time steadily. Not too fast. Not too fast. Sometimes when you come up to me at the end of the Dhamma sermon and you talk to me about all the good things you've been doing last week, the previous weeks, I tell you, whoa, 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 sir, not that fast. But there'll be people in the audience who will bear evidence to that. Sometimes I tell you, slow down. Because sometimes the pace that you're going at in your lay life is too fast. In those moments, I ask you to slow down a little bit. Because slow and steady wins this race. You can't do a run and a somersault to Nibbana. It doesn't work like that. You've got to be slow. You've got to be steady. Slow is fine as long as you are steady. If you start running at 100 miles an hour, you know, and you're on the motorway, right? And you're in a Maruti, you're not going to get very far. If you want to go at 100 miles an hour, get into a Porsche. Find a Ferrari. I'm in one. That's why we come in red. If you want to go at that speed, right, then you need a path that has been paved for that. You need to have those obstructions moved out of the way. But if you have to slow down at every bend, at every nook and corner, you have to check your mirrors, right? And then there are cows jumping the streets and dogs walking across, right? If you have these things going on, right, then you have to be very careful. You can't go at faster than 30 miles an hour, perhaps. But as you progress, right, those obstructions will not be so distractive. It will become easier to maneuver then. But for that, just give yourself time. So you can't be a rocket to Nibbana. Sometimes you might be a bicycle. Maybe not a motorbike, even maybe just a push bicycle. You've got to pedal yourself to Nibbana. And so be it. Remember, it was the tortoise that won the race, not the rabbit. As far as I'm concerned, I don't really care too much about, let me put it this way, I don't care as much about the speed at which you progress as I do about the fact that you are progressing gradually, steadily, and properly. That is what I care more about, not the speed. Speed will come with time. So don't try to get to fifth gear right at the start. First, you've got to start on first gear. Then get yourself a second gear. Then third gear. That way, it seems comfortable. It's doable. It seems reachable. So all these things you have to bear in mind. That's why I say, you know, it's difficult enough trying to do this as a monk. Then I can only imagine what it must be like where you are right now. But then to have all these distractions just to, you know, blow you out of the path. Don't let that happen to you. Especially, you know, things, deeds you might have done in samsara. This will give me an opportunity to talk to the parents here. Things you might have done in samsara. Things like stopping your children when they wanted to go into the sasana. Right? When you want to attain Nibbana, they come back to bite you. After all, you know, there is no such thing called I am the mother, he is the son. When it comes to Nibbana, no rules. That's all out. Because all those are all conventions. Plus I often tell you, parents, right? If at some point your children feel like the sasana is the place for them, Nibbana is the place for them. And for that they want to go and dedicate themselves entirely to the practice of the path. It's very unfortunate if you have to be the one who ends up stopping them. Because here's what will happen. One day you will also want that. And then it's going to be tit for tat. What you've given will come back to you. So either don't get your children to listen to any of this stuff. Then you will also never get to listen to this. Give or deny, that's what God is. But, because you know, most of the time what I say is, parents, they want their children to be good. Yeah, they want their children to not do drugs. They want their children not to take alcohol and not to get intoxicated, you know, not to fall for substances, to come out of their habits such as pornography and watching TV and being addicted to their gaming consoles. So they bring the children to the monastery. They bring the children to the sermons. And then we start preaching to them. And then, a few weeks on, the child's like, I got it. I want it. I want to become a monk. And then the parents are like, too much of anything is bad, no Buddha. The reason for that is, you know, that is what we were trained, you know, right from when you observe the fifth precept. Suna mere majjhapama, remember? Not too much. Just a little bit. That got ingrained in our heads and now we think the same about everything. So anyhow, the long and the short of all that is, people are entitled to their opinions. Let them hold on to their opinions. They may mock you, they may criticize you, they may shame you even. And say, you know, what are you people? Are you silly? Are you fools? Are you mad? Are you crazy to listen to these talks? If you are serious about your salvation, then don't fall for that. Don't even go back to them with a reply. Some, they just want to create a commotion. On some channels, they just want to publicize their channels, and the more activity they have in their comment section, the more the YouTube algorithms pick those videos up and you know, they start appearing in people's feeds. That is a strategy. Why do you have to be the lab rat for that? Just don't fall for that. Laser sharp focus. Nibbana and nothing more. Don't come here for anything but Nibbana. This noble association that we have managed to build over the last several months, right? You are all here for one and you are all here for all. I know hand on heart that you are all here and you do everything you do as a community because you care about Nibbana. I think you owe it to everyone here to dedicate your focus to that purpose. Keep your focus on that. There may come a point where you realize, you know, Nibbana is not for me. I don't know. It doesn't feel like Nibbana is for me. Yeah, I tried it. It's not for me. Then it's fine. Right? You might decide to go back to whatever you were doing on a Sunday morning and it's fine. It's fine. That's okay as well because everyone has their time. There's a time and a place for everyone. Maybe not this time. Maybe you are a Maitri Buddha's disciple. That's perfectly fine. I was not a Kakusanda Konagamana Buddha's disciple, was I? I took my time. It had to be Gautam Buddha who was going to be my teacher. So in the same way, there will be those for whom their teacher is going to be the Maitri Buddha. And it might be that as they listen to these talks, they'll be like, no, this doesn't make sense. What is this? It's rubbish, nonsense. It's okay. Let them have their own opinions. All I'm saying is don't you go get engaged and embroiled in those conversations. Don't stoop yourself to that lower level. We are respectable people, if nothing else. We respect the fact that everyone is entitled to their opinion. We don't hurt others' feelings, intentionally at least. So everyone who has an opinion, they can have their. If someone comes up to me and says, you're ugly, you think I'm going to argue with them? All I'm going to say is, thankfully, someone else agrees. Because then, you know, they have no grounds to fight with me, do they? Now, you know, especially if someone's hurt, one of the best things you can do is just agree with them. Have I not told you this before? If someone comes up to you and starts barking, just say sorry. Even when you know that you are right and they're wrong, just say sorry. Because the moment you say, do it out of compassion. A chitta is a chitta is a chitta. Just do it out of compassion. Why it's so hard? What does it cost you? A sorry? What does it cost you? Nothing. You know, they come up to you, they've got their knickers in a twist. Just say sorry. They don't know what they're going on about. Just say sorry. Because then all that pressure that is building inside, they can relieve that pressure. And now they can regain a state of composure. Now they might just sit down and listen to the talk. And then what might happen? Miracles. If we don't see the wood for the trees, then we are very short-sighted. We must always look at what awaits them. Angulimala, Arahat would await him. And the Buddha saw that. He looked beyond the present moment and he saw a great future for Angulimala. So he shed his compassion. He shed his compassion. And with out of compassion, Arahatan Vansi was born out of a murderer. Yeah? So I want all of you to be like that. So may these words remain online or wherever for as long as they do and people listen to them. They will take on this advice. Once again, none of this is meant to offend. And if you feel offended, then you got it the wrong way. That was not my intention. Now from time to time, the other thing is from time to time, there are certain things that I want to get across to you. Certain truths. Like for example, you know, what it's like in the four great hells. There are certain things I want to share with you. But, you know, in the back of my mind, I know there are going to be skeptics out there who will say, nonsense. What else? You know, there are certain things, ladies and gentlemen, that it would be wise for us to accept as is, provided that there's nothing to lose by accepting it. You just accept it for the time being and just let time make sense of all of that for you. But you know, if you are not open-minded, that becomes incredibly difficult. Let me explain what I mean by that. Say, for instance, I want to get across to you the fact that if when you are able to do something for yourself and by yourself, you keep on pestering your parents, for instance, you keep on bothering your mother, you keep on bothering your father, and when you are well and truly capable of doing that for yourself, you die and you become a preta. That is a fact. But there's going to be someone in the audience who will say, prove it. The proof will come later. I mean, not once you become a preta. The proof will come in the Dhamma, but you got to come along to a few more sermons for that. Because I can't give you all of it in one talk. But then here's the thing. What if you die before you hear that part? Because you can still take the action, can't you, of not doing the bad deed, with or without the rationale? Because I haven't asked you to do something bad. All I said was, if you are capable of doing something on your own, right? And because, you know, nowadays, you know, people, young children, what they were just, they're just stuck behind their computers, you know, stuck behind their gaming consoles, and they're, Amma, tea. Like mother is a tea boy. Amma, lunch. I mean, lunch is there, you can go and get it yourself, right? But can't be asked. Can't be bothered. So they start treating their parents like servants. What they don't realize is, this is accruing lots and lots of demerit. These demerits will ultimately result in such individuals, upon death, to be born as a preta. I can explain to you how that happens, but you've got to give me some time. But let's say it takes me another 3 sermons to explain this to you. If I don't give you the fact today, for the next 3 weeks, what are you going to be doing? You're going to be doing that, aren't you? And we can't undo the demerit. Once it's done, it's done. It's not like your understanding of the Dhamma, or rather, at least, your merits are not going to wash away all your demerits. It doesn't work like that. You have to pay it all. You've got to pay it all back. There's only one way out of it, and that is by becoming a sotapanna. If you become a sotapanna, then you are free from the 4 great hells once and for all. You don't no longer become a preta. You no longer become an animal, a tirisan, tirachana yoni. You are free from the aviti. You are free from all the nirayas. The 4 great hells you are free from, once and for all. And the asuranikaya, you are free from that. Not the deva asura, there's an asura in the 4 great hells. That's one type of hell worlds. You're free from that. But, you know, over the next 3 weeks, I'm going to explain to you little by little. But it's going to take you 3 weeks to understand that. In those 3 weeks, what are you going to be doing? The same things, right? So would you rather me not tell you up front, right at the start, you know, these are some things you should not be doing? Because at least the next 3 weeks, you'll be living virtuously and not earning demerit because of your ignorance. But then is there someone in the audience who says, not until you prove to me, am I going to stop that? Whose loss is that? Mine? Now someone was telling me that someone's been commenting somewhere. Now last week we talked about how beauty is not in the sight. And we just started explaining this concept, right? So you've got to give it a few more weeks so I can give more examples and help you understand this. But there will be someone somewhere who will just catch on to something that does not agree with their opinion, because they have long lived their lives thinking that beauty is in the object. You know, because, you know, they're married to someone who they thought was beautiful. And all of, you know, from nowhere, Swami Nasa comes and says, beauty is not in the object. Of course they don't want to accept that. That's like saying your wife is not beautiful anymore. They don't want to accept that. No wonder. But then, if just because it does not agree with your opinion, if you completely disregard that, and then not just that, you decide, no, from here on I don't want to listen to these sermons anymore, and by the way, I'm going to leave a comment so that anyone else who bumps into this don't listen to these sermons either. You know, where the Dhamma is concerned, you've got to be very careful, because this is like no other. The Buddha gives a simile. He says, the Dhamma is like a serpent. If you want to catch a serpent, you've got to catch it by its head. Just below its head, by its neck. So that it cannot turn around and bite you. If you catch it anywhere else, it's going to wrangle itself around and it's going to bite you. This is the Buddha's word. He gives his simile. He says, when you're dealing with the Dhamma, be very, very, very careful. Just like your mother and your father, when you're dealing with them, be very careful. When you're dealing with an arahant, be very careful. Because as much as you can earn merits by dealing with them rightly, you can also earn lots of demerit by dealing with them in the wrong way. And I often tell people, and I know I'm just jesting, but truth be told, if I had it my way, I'd make parents help their children become sotapannas as the first thing they do, if possible, even before they start sending them to primary school. You know why? Because at least once they become a sotapanna, they are living with their parents, don't you get it? These children, at home you live with your parents. And parents are like hot water. When you have a sore throat, there's nothing better than that. But if you spill it over yourself, you're scalded for life. You're burned for life. That mark remains with you forever. So if you love your children, honestly, and you want to keep them home, otherwise send them to a hostel or somewhere, then it's okay. If you want to keep your children at home, please help them to understand the Dhamma so that they don't earn demerits by dealing with you in the wrong way. Because to them, they're just your child. But to you, they're just your children. But to them, you are their parents. Remember what the Buddha said? Kill a mother, kill a father. That's a heinous sin. You cannot escape from that for a very, very, very long time. This is about going into the avithi. But you know, anything this side of killing? What about if you slap your mother? If you slapped your mother? If killing takes you into the avithi, what about a slap? What about if you shout at her and speak to her in a harsh way? If you use harsh words with her? If you deliberately try to hurt her feelings? You're messing with fire here. But parents don't think about these things because they don't know much about these things. They think the first thing you've got to teach your children is the alphabet. They think the first thing you've got to teach your children is how to use a phone, how to use a computer, how to use the internet. Whereas, the first thing you've got to teach your children is, we are your parents. Understand who parents are. I wish more parents were more sensible about the ways in which they teach their children these things. Because what you find these days, folks, is a lot of the time, you know, parents, they don't know this stuff, so the children don't ever get to learn this stuff. And the children, they grow older. Right? After a while, you know, some children, they are taller, they're stronger than their own parents. Boys are stronger than their fathers. Right? Girls are stronger than their mothers. And then after a while, you know, they just want it their way, when they want it, where they have to have it, when they want to have it. That's the kind of society we live in. If you want some pocket money, it has to be given then and there. If you want to buy something, it has to be bought for them then and there. If you want a phone, it has to be given to you then and there. It's very difficult to negotiate with children nowadays. This is what parents tell me. Because if they have to have it their way, oh, they just get very rowdy. And they start quarreling. And then, you know, you're leaving your children to mess with fire. So out of compassion, I think what parents should do first and foremost is to give the children the Dhamma, so at least they're not messing with you. You're the wrong people to be messing with if you're the mother and the father. Otherwise, give them up and, you know, to an orphanage or something. At least there, they might get a stepmother or a stepfather. It's not the biological mother and father. So hurting them is not as bad as hurting you. Do you get the point, folks? If you want to bring children into this world, it's not just a case of giving them birth. Anyone can do that. That's a biological process. But then from there on, you have a great responsibility. Bringing a child into this world is no easy matter. Because this is a human being. This is someone who has just escaped from hell. You know, you're giving them another lease of life in the Sugati. Just imagine you know, a guy who got imprisoned for 30 years, he's released on parole. How do you treat this person? After 30 years in prison, he comes out. And he's still got a temperament of hurting others. You know, if he went into prison for murder, right, for 30 years he's been in prison, he's still got a temperament of being a bit like that. Now you want to be very careful with him, right? So that he doesn't go and engage in such deeds again. Now, in the same way, when people are born as human beings, if what the Buddha said was right, we have all become human beings after having spent a terribly long time in the four great hells. So when you give birth to a baby boy or a baby girl, ladies and gentlemen, please be mindful that they've just about escaped the four hells. They've just had a chance to come back as a human being. Now, how must you protect them? How must you treat them? How must you teach them so that they don't fall back to the same pit that they came out of? They just escaped. So there's a great responsibility on mothers and fathers, on parents, on teachers, to instill this stuff in children's minds. That's why it's very important to give your children the Dhamma. But that's another matter. What? What time did we start? The time on this is 10:15. Is that right? Jeez. I thought we'd been speaking for like 15 minutes or something. So what have you taken away from that? Let the commenters comment. Let the haters hate. Those who love will love. Those who hate will hate. Right? Your part is to play your part for your own salvation. We are all here for Nibbana and nothing more. If you bump onto a YouTube channel and you don't like what is being said, just leave it alone. There are many more channels online. Just find the one that works for you. And I was saying, the reason that I'm a bit hesitant sometimes to share some of these things, which some might feel are skeptical, so some skeptics might struggle to come to terms with, is because, you know, I mean, I like to call a spade a spade. But then there are those who don't. They want to call a spade a fancy spoon. So when I say, you know, you do these things and you're going to be born in the hells, people don't like that. And here's why they don't like that. Because they want to do those things. They just don't like people criticizing that. I think I've told you this before. At the workplace, whatever you've given to do your job at the workplace is for the workplace. Don't ever walk home with even something as an item of stationery. If it's for the workplace, it's for the workplace. Don't take a pen, a pencil, a sheet of paper, or even a paper clip. Don't take it home, because it is customary for people to do this sort of thing. When your child calls you and says, "Mama, I don't have a pen to write. Ah, don't worry, Putta, I'll bring you one on the way. You don't stop on the way and take one from the shop. You take the one that's at work. It's been given to you to do your work stuff. What you don't know is you're stealing on behalf of the child. That is theft. But you know, when I say these things, people start challenging me. They'll say, no, how can that be theft? Aren't we entitled to that? Well, if you are entitled to that, you know, you should be giving out pens to people who walk on the streets. You are given that pen to do your job, not to take it home with you. That's how you get a pay. You get paid to buy a pen if you need one for home. Don't take this one home. Some people use their mobile phones, work phones, to make personal phone calls. They don't realize that in doing so, they are committing theft. And you know what people will tell me as soon as I say this? Prove it to us, otherwise you don't believe it. I'm telling you. I'm not saying something bad, right? I'm asking you to do something that is good. So when I'm asking you to do something good, don't wait for the full rationale of it and for me to explain to you to the nth degree how everything works out, because I can do. And it'll take us a little time, but in that time you're still committing the unmeritorious deed. You're going to be sorry you did that. So if something seems sensible, just do it. But I'm not asking you to do that with Nibbana. I'll draw a clear line and distinguish those two things. With Nibbana, don't do just what I ask you to do. Listen to it, analyze it, reflect upon it, and then practice it. But here I'm asking you to do things which will end up with you going into the four great hells. Because if you go there, then what's the point of talking about it after that? What's lost is lost. So if there are those in the audience who will come and question me, Swami Nas, I'm not going to believe in any of this stuff you talk about, the four great hells, until you show it to me. Sometimes out of compassion, we don't talk about these things. But then that seems like a disservice to those who are willing to accept. That is where sometimes I'm torn. Now, I don't know what to do. What's right, what's wrong? Do I share it so that there are those who would benefit from it, can take these words of advice on and actually start to make sense of it, and they don't need the full explanation of it, because as long as it seems sensible and Swami Nohan say you have some trust, only speaks out of compassion and pure love and affection for you, you know, you take it on board and start practicing it. Or if you're someone who's a complete skeptic and says, no, I'm not going to accept it, that because it does not agree with what I think, and I'm not going to stop at that, I'm going to go around telling everyone that he's just making up stuff. Because when you have people like that, the innocent people, they become victims. Innocent people who have not yet even listened to the Dhamma, they become victims. So I don't know what to say and what not to say. Especially in that regard. When it comes to Nibbana, the Dhamma, you know, the core Dhamma, it doesn't matter. But there are certain things in life, you know, just general advice that I'd like to share, but sometimes I pull myself back and I think, I don't know. Because amongst the regulars, there are newcomers as well. And that's okay. That's perfectly fine, because every regular was once a newcomer. But then there are those who are very opinionated and adamant, not willing to change their opinions. So I suppose the best thing I can do is give you this piece of advice. That is, you are your only salvation. If you want to listen to and do what every Tom, Dick and Harry says to you, then you must do it at your own peril. If, however, you are sensible with what you do, and you're open-minded, and you're willing to acknowledge, accept, analyze, reflect, you know, be intelligent about the way you practice the path and take on the practice of the Dhamma, then, you know, once again, what you reap is what you sow. So in this path, ladies and gentlemen, because I can only show you the path, I can't twist your arm, can I? I can't say, do it or else. With none of you can I do that. With all of you, all I can do, the best I can do is say, madam, think about this. Sir, just think about this. Just think about this. This is all I can say. I can't be hard and fast on you. I can't draw a hard line and say, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. I mean, I can, but it wouldn't be right. There will be some here who will say, Swami Nasa, just tell me what to do and I'll do it exactly to the letter. The only reason I'm still here is because I have some duties and responsibilities and I have no way out of them so far. I can't see a way out of it. This is the only reason I'm here. But if you told me to go and jump off a cliff, I'll do it right now. I'm like that. If my teacher tells me to go jump off a cliff, I will do that because I have understood what he has said. I have understood it. So I know he's never going to ask me to jump off a cliff. But I can today, I have come to a point where everything he says makes perfect sense. But this is not blind faith. There is no blind, you can't get to Nibbana with blind faith. You can't. You can go to heaven with blind faith, yes. But not to Nibbana, you can't get there with blind faith. It has to be through conviction. In fact, one who has escaped from the four great hells is one who has first and foremost come to conviction. Shraddha only appears in the mind of a Sotapanna. Until then, what you have is bhakti, which is faith. Shraddha is your conviction. Once you have seen the Dhamma, you have seen it. No one in this world can change your mind about it. No one. Not even a Buddha can come and convince you otherwise. So, what I urge you all to do, ladies and gentlemen, is take the Dhamma from these sermons. Make sense of it and let them transform you internally so that you can achieve to that state. Because after all, that is what we are all here for, to become Sotapannas. Once you're a Sotapanna, you know, you can practice on your own. Yes, of course, having a teacher in your presence is always going to be helpful. You can progress faster on your journey. But once you're a Sotapanna, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, Nibbana is well within reach. Until then, there is no guarantee whatsoever. So how does one become a Sotapanna then? Should be your next question. How does one become a Sotapanna? You need your merits to help you do that. That's why I always urge you and remind you to engage in as many merits as you possibly can. Do your merits. And merits start where? Where does charity start? At home. Start at home. In the same breath with which I said, be careful with your mother and father, I'll also tell you, you are blessed to have your mother and father. Because these are, you know, it's like a wishing well. You know what a wishing well is? You've seen them? Where you can just go and throw a penny or something into it and make a wish. Parents are pretty much like that. I know someone will say, you're right, Swami Nasa. I asked him for an Xbox, I got one. That's not what I'm talking about. With your parents, you can wish for as many merits as you like. You know, from time to time I talk about this, how you should be dealing with your parents. And today, as we are on the topic, we might as well a few words about that. You know, for some of you, you are still fortunate to have your parents with you. You're still fortunate. They're still alive. Remember, you're not going to have this blessing forever. While you still have them with you, exploit them. In what way? Make use of them to earn as much merits as you possibly can. When your father gets home from work, why don't you be the one who goes and offers him a glass of water? You have no idea how much merits that bring you. Our ancestors, they had this as a practice. Usually it used to be the wife who would take a glass of water on a saucer and go and offer it to the husband. It used to be like that. But children can do the same. Today I remember when I was in my lay life, you know, I was around 15, 16, that sort of time. My father, he had muscle aches in his legs. And I remember to this day, he used to be a teacher at some point in his life. And he would spend the whole day standing, teaching in class. And then when he got back home, he'd say, Putra, can you give me a leg massage, please? So I'd do it every time. Every single time he asked me, I'd do it. Not always willingly, though. I must admit, not always willingly. Sometimes, you know, there were days I'd much rather watch TV. Or, you know, go and speak to a friend or something. Or, you know, read something or play some games or whatever. But I always did it. There was never a complaint, although there were complaints inside, I never voiced them. If he gave me the chance to do that today, Now that I understand how valuable and precious parents are, I do it wholeheartedly. But of course today he doesn't make that offering to me. As a monk. So if ever, you know, your parents come up to you and say, it's been a hectic day today, so tired, offer a head massage. Offer a leg massage. Offer them. Because these are your parents, unlike any other. Only second to treating an arahant is treating your parents. You can only do them while they're still with you. Once they're gone, they're gone. So when they come back home, and if you can make them some tea, why is it that they always have to make the tea for you? You make the tea. If you don't know how, ask them. Learn. Serve the food. You be the one who does that. And you tell them, Amma, I have today realized what a blessing I have to have you with me today. So please, whenever I have a chance, let me do some merits by helping you. Let you know, have them, you know, pre-warned so they know what's going on. Otherwise they might think you're trying to get something out of them. They'll ask you otherwise, right? What are you coming up to? What are you getting up to? What do you want? Just out with it. What do you want? So tell them up front. Swami Nasa explained to us today how fortunate we are to have our parents with us still. So please, whenever I have the chance, let me do that. If the washing machine breaks down at home, don't let it be your mother who washes the clothes. You go do that. And worst of all, don't get your mother to wash your underwear for you. Don't get your parents to do your washing for you. They're your parents. If you're very young and you don't know how to do these things, fair enough. But after a while you grow up, you know, you learn how to manage yourself, how to do your own things, then you become the one who makes use of these opportunities to earn yourself merits. Treat them like gods, I tell you. You'll be glad you did. Treat them like gods. If ever something wrong happens to you, because of doing what I tell you to do, come back and let me know. Swami Nasa, you taught us to treat them like gods, and I did. And look at me today. I'm a mess. I dare you. Come and tell me one day. It is because you treated your parents like gods, you are in a mess. Come and tell me one day if you can. I dare you. It will never happen. If the Buddha was right, then these words are right. And parents, please encourage your children to be pious towards yourselves, to have that devotion towards you, to be loyal to you, have that, you know, instill that within their minds and hearts. Don't feel like you're making servants out of them. Don't feel that way. That's wrong to think like that. Because sometimes, you know, modern parents might feel that way. To get my children to do things for me feels like I'm enslaving them. No, not so. You're paving a path for them, a straight, fast track to heaven. That's what you're doing. So give them those opportunities. Don't let them fall victim to what, you know, their friends might say at school. Because at school, these kind of things might not get respect and regard. Your child goes to school and his friends ask him, what do you do for the weekend? Weekend, I clean the house, I wash clothes, and my mother was ill, so I had to tend to her. But it might be that the rest of them will start laughing at him. They'll start mocking him. They say, that's what you did over the weekend? We played games, we went on trips, we went to the beach, we had fun. And you were just at home like a slave? Slaving to your mother? Loser, they'll start saying. These things happen. We live in the 21st century, you know. Values, virtues, all these things are now down the drain. And people wonder why they don't see a way out of suffering. When they have everything that money can buy, but happiness, is out of reach. For Nibbana to take seed, you need fertile soil. Anuttaram punya ketta. You've heard that, haven't you? Anuttaram punya ketta is a fertile ground for the seed of Nibbana to take root. And that fertile ground are the values and the virtues that we cultivate. It's the environment that we create for ourselves in respecting our parents, in respecting our teachers, in fulfilling our duties and responsibilities to others, being kind and being generous and all of these things, folks. There is no fast track to Nibbana. There isn't. Honestly, there isn't. There's no fast track to Nibbana. Then you'll ask me, what about Dharucirya? He was the quickest in the Buddha's asana to attain Nibbana. The Buddha only had to say, Dharucirya ditte ditta mattang, sute sutta mattang, mute muta mattang, vinyate vinyata mattang. And Dharucirya has become an arahatamansi. So you'll ask me, wasn't that a fast track? The answer is no. What you don't know is all the things that he did up until that point. So that he was a flower waiting to blossom, just on the verge of it. That you don't know. Because that part of the story has not been told. There is no fast track to Nibbana. It's a slow and steady race. Creating the right environment is as important as reflecting on the Dhamma. I want all of us to be dedicated and serious about Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, because I know that this method works. Okay? I will never come up here and say something I don't do myself personally. Because I have to take responsibility for what I say. Don't I? Don't you want me to be responsible for what I ask you to do? Because if I ask you to do something and you go crazy, I've got to be responsible for that. You know, we are doing a mind hack here, aren't we? I mean, really strictly speaking, this is a mind hack. I'm actually changing the ways in you think. It's not like changing your diet. What's the worst that can happen if I change your diet? You have a bad tummy. You get hospitalized for a couple of weeks or so, and then you're back home and you're back to normal. But if I say the wrong things to you, and you start doing the wrong things, you can end up going crazy. And worse than that, you can end up in the four great hells. So I've got to be very responsible about what I say. That's why Guru Hanumanthu said the other day, he also listens to some of these talks whenever he gets the time. I'm so glad that he does. Because if ever I say something that is out of line, or if ever I say something that is not accurate, then my teacher will be quick to point it out for me, so that the following week I can come back and tell you, that's not how it should be, let's correct that. So besides a couple of stories, I've not had to say that to you. Because the Dhamma, I'm confident in. I speak out of conviction. Maybe some historical stories, if I get the names wrong, then he corrects me and I'll come and tell you, that was not the name, it was not Dharucirya, it was someone else. But with the Dhamma, I speak a conviction. But I'm responsible with what I say. So, if you are serious about Nibbana, it's important that you're careful with the path that you take, because Nibbana is a mind hack. It's about the way you think. Your perspective will change about life. So you've got to be careful. Don't be too fast. Don't be too slow either. Find your optimum speed. And ensure that you create the conducive environment for Nibbana to take root. And then from there on, just practice and practice and practice. Now last week I spoke to you about beauty and how it's an illusion. I would love to know that some of you, at least in the audience, would have gone back home and reflected on that. And the moments where you saw beauty, where you experienced beauty, at least if you took a moment to ask yourself, how is it that I'm seeing beauty that does not exist in the object? Because that was the theory that we discussed in the class. Class, sermon, wherever. So you needed to have given yourself some time to contemplate on that. If you did that, then here's what would have happened. In your lap of life, it would have been true. Now it becomes your conviction rather than just my word. Let me remind you, because I promised you, let's take a, do a quick refresh before we conclude for today. So I can give you again another chance to reflect on this, so that the next week, if you couldn't do last week, you can reflect on it. And if you did, then you can continue doing that. Any picture, any sight out there, there are those, if I present a sight to you, you will tell me it's beauty, it's pretty, others will say it's not so. Right? The best example are people. Some people you find are good looking and some you don't. But everyone is beautiful to somebody. Aren't they? Everyone's beautiful to somebody. But there's no one in this world who's beautiful to everybody. Someone asked me the question last week about Aishwarya. So I'll give you an answer to that question now that we are at it. How come many people find her pretty? And the reason for that is, ladies and gentlemen, from a very young age, before we get to see Aishwarya, the definition of beauty is implanted in our minds piece by piece. That's what happens to us as we grow up. You know, when we grow up, we are influenced by people that we see around us. Think about this for a second. Do you not remember, maybe when you were younger, someone said something like this to you or to someone else and you were in their presence? You know, in countries like ours, it's considered attractive to be fair. Yeah? In these countries, it's considered attractive to be fair. Now, don't ask me whether that is right or wrong. I'm just stating fact. In countries like ours, everyone's trying to be fair. Not fair and square fair. Fair of complexion. In some countries, it's dark. To be dark is to be attractive. So it's a very subjective thing. Isn't it? Now, have you not heard when you were younger, someone having said about this about you or about someone else that you'd seen? You know, especially when it's a young child. Have you not heard, like, maybe your granny or your auntie or someone else saying, Sudhu Baba. Not heard that? Not heard that? Oh, it's sweet, isn't it? Sudhu Baba. You have not heard that? Have you ever heard someone say, Kalu Baba? That you don't hear, do you? Do you know that those words influence you? Even when you are so young, these are your formative years. Every word leaves an imprint in your mind. That's why your association is very important. You are the product of the five people you spend most of your time with. Let me speak to the five people you spend most of your time with, and I'll give you a head-to-toe description of the kind of person that you are. I don't even need to talk to you. Such is how profound the effect is of the people who indoctrinate you with all these things. So I think you'll agree with me that when we were younger, we've heard so many of these things. Then do you remember watching on TV these TV adverts where they advertise soap and creams and lotions and all these things, and they call them what lotions? What creams? Fairness creams. Have you seen a single advert where someone takes a bar of soap and they apply it on themselves and then they say at the end of that, you know, after applying this, I'm darker than I was. Name one advert you've seen where that was said. Ever? No, what do you hear? After applying this soap, after using this cream, I'm fairer than I was. Now do you see what those words, those adverts do to you? Because you don't have the Dhamma yet. So you have nothing to compare and contrast these indoctrinations, because you don't have a truth to check it with. You don't have the answer key to check these with. So, you know, at the beginning, fair and dark are on a level playing field. This is at the beginning. Fair and dark are our level. But then you start listening to what these grannies say. Sudhu Baba. Then what happens is, this is fair, this is dark, this rises up. In value. In your mind, fairness is more valuable than darkness. Then you start watching the adverts. Then they say fairness cream. Fair and lovely. See, just think about the way it's been named. Just think about how it's named. Apologies for using a brand name in the talk, but I'm just trying to explain to you a point here. Just think about why it's named like that. Have you ever come across a cream called dark and lovely? No, you see, fair and lovely. So what does that tell you about fair? Being fair is lovely. So of course everyone knows that lovely is a good thing. So now when they use these two words together, what that tells you is being fair is lovely. Indoctrinations. One piece at a time, the world that you live in indoctrinates you to have a specific view on the world. You are taught how to think. That's why the other day I told you, you know, all of these opinions that you have, your preferences, your likes, ultimately they are not yours. I think I said this to you many, many, many sermons ago. Although you think you want something, you like something, you think that this is your choice. You spoke about choice, that's the one. You spoke about choice. Your choice is not your choice at all, because all these choices, they are influenced by the indoctrinations that someone else has put into your mind. This is what happens. Then you start, you know, you really start reading magazines, right? Newspapers, things and so on. And a lot of the time, in these magazines, right, nowadays it's not so much, but back then it was big, right? On the front cover of a magazine, in the pages, right, in the glossy magazines, most of the time you'd see fair people. So fairness always got more attraction, always got more value. And it was treated as the better complexion. What is Aishwarya? Fair or dark? She's fair. Now that's one part. One part of Aishwarya. Next. Nose. Some have crooked noses. Some have wonky noses. Some have straight noses. Whenever, you know, even going back again as a child, right, you'd have grown up in an environment where people would have inspected you, you know, even when you were carried as a baby. Right? They would have, you've heard comments, people saying things about you. Lassananaya, beautiful nose, isn't it? Beautiful lips. Look at those eyes. Blue eyes. See, blue eyes, they always got more value than dark eyes. Green eyes, blue eyes, brown eyes, they always got more value than dark eyes. These are all indoctrinations. And then the eyes, you know, if they were sharp, pointy eyes, right? Those things got more value. And you know, then the makeup. You know, when you put your makeup on, you try to highlight your eyes and its shape and so on, right? And then, you know, and then that's what actors, actresses, you know, people who are models, they come on social media, they go on TV, and then this is the picture of perfection that they show. There's a picture of perfection that has to do with every single part of your visible body. Right from your hair to your feet. There's a phone going off. Where was I? Yeah, right from your hair. Sorry, if you have a phone, it's always good to just switch it on mute when you're in the sermon, because I get distracted. And then sometimes I lose my train of thought. So just as a courtesy to everyone, next time it will be best if you can just switch your phones on mute. Happens to the best of us. I've done it. Happened to me as well. And then someone told me to put my phone on mute, and then from that day on I did. So happens to the best of us. Back to hair. Right from every strand of hair to your feet. there is a picture of perfection somewhere out there. You know, when you walk up to the mirror and you look yourself in the mirror, isn't there an image in the back of your mind with which you compare yourself? When you start doing your makeup, when you start doing your hair, isn't there a picture in the back of your mind with which you compare yourself? Where did that picture come from? This image that you have in your mind, where did that come from? You weren't born with that. You certainly weren't born with that. Like I said, for some, it's going to be dark complexion. For some, it's going to be fair complexion. For some, the hair is going to be colored. For some, the hair is going to be, say, auburn. For some, it's going to be blonde. It's going to be different one for different people. But these are all indoctrinations that were picked up as we grew up. Over time, these indoctrinations, they stick. And what marketing does, what media does, is it keeps saying the same thing over and over and over and over again. And then ultimately, the same people who do the cosmetics, the same people who do the TV, the same people who do the brands, they conduct Miss Universe. Now think about the science behind all that. You first create an image of what perfection is, and then you create a stage so that people who are as close as possible to that image of perfection can now come and stand on and present themselves to society. And of course, if you ask them, how did you become so attractive? I used that cream. I used this hairspray. I used that hairbrush. I used this toothpaste. If you ask many people who stand on a stage and you know, present themselves in that way, they'll all have something they'll talk about as to what products they use to beautify themselves. Once again, nothing wrong with that. I've got nothing wrong. I've got no problem with that. But what I'm saying is, because you asked me the question, how come many people find Aishwarya so attractive? It's because most of us, as we grew up, these were the same indoctrinations that we all got planted in our minds. Because media is responsible for a lot of the ways in which we make our choices. What we saw on TV, what we saw in the newspapers, what we saw in the adverts, what we saw on the pop-ups, what we saw on the phones, what we saw in social media, all of these things, ladies and gentlemen, they just kept on bombarding us with the perfection, with the image of perfection. Because we didn't have the Dhamma, there was nothing to contrast it with. There was nothing to compare it with. There was nothing to check it against, nothing to verify that. So therefore, we just accepted it at face value. And having accepted it at face value, we just allowed those indoctrinations to settle within us, and that became our image of perfection. So therefore, now if Aishwarya comes and stands on stage, without you even knowing it, you scan her from head to toe. You don't even know you're doing this. You check her hair and you check it against your image of what good, nice looking hair looks needs to look like. Then you check her forehead. You check whether there are wrinkles on it. All that gets checked with your database. This database has been formed over a number of years, not just once or twice. Over a number of years, these indoctrinations have been happening within your mind. If I asked you to draw, let's say you were all very good artists, if I asked you to draw a picture of the most beautiful woman in this world, right? You can all draw one. Assuming you're all good artists, you can all draw one. And there'll be many features in every drawing that'll be similar. So if I collected all those drawings from you and we put it up on screen, you will find many features that will be the same. For example, you might say hourglass figure. For instance, it's not necessarily because you have one. But that's because that is what has been fed into your mind. Because when you watch TV, when you watch movies, people who are attractive, or at least so-called attractive, people who are supposed to be attractive, they have an hourglass figure, so therefore you begin to think that an hourglass figure is the figure that is attractive. These things have all happened within you without you even knowing it. That's why Aishwarya is attractive to many. Because it didn't stop with one, it happened with many of us. But having said all that, beauty is still not with Aishwarya. So forgive me for saying this, but Aishwarya is not beautiful. And that's not perhaps in the way that you thought I meant it. To me, everyone is beautiful. Because beauty is not in the object. Once you realize that beauty is not in the object, you see the beauty that comes with everything. It's perfect the way it is. You are perfect the way you are. Maybe you're a bit saggy. Maybe you've got a bit too much around your tummy. Maybe you've got some wrinkles. Maybe you're dark. Maybe you've got freckles. Maybe your hair's grown gray. You know what? You're beautiful just as you are. Because I don't have an image of beauty to compare you with. The reason you suffer is because you have an image of what beauty looks like. Therefore, you can't walk in front of the mirror without criticizing the way you look. Don't you agree? That's why every day you wake up in the morning, you go stand in front of the mirror, you have a picture of perfection, and you know what? This is like a punishment to you. Unfortunately, it's like a punishment. You have to stand in front of the mirror and look at that face of yours that's staring back at you and compare and contrast that with your image of perfection. After a while, there's only so much you can do to fix the drooping skin, to fix the skin that starts to get all old and wrinkly. There's only so much you can do. Cosmetics can only look after you for a certain time. But your picture of perfection, that always is there with you. But once your hair starts growing gray, and then after your hair starts falling out, now what do you do? That's why we have wigs, some in one. So. See, what science and technology does is always try to fill that gap, but it never addresses the problem. The problem is not the fact that your image does not match with the image that you have in your mind. That's not the problem, ladies and gentlemen. The real problem is you have an image in the back of your mind. But that attachment is responsible for. That is ignorance doing that. But because science does not know anything about ignorance and attachment, all they can do is offer you a plaster for the problem. They can't fix the problem. They give you a temporary fix. All your cosmetics have always been temporary. All those wigs that you wear, it's all been temporary. You can go under the knife and get yourself some, surgery, but all of that is still temporary. People get Botox treatments. It's become a thing. I mean, it has been in the Western world for a long time, but now I think it's becoming pretty common, even in our countries. Surgery, enhancement surgery, facial enhancements, chest enhancements, buttock enhancements, all parts of the body, now fair game for enhancement. Don't you see how people suffer? Is it not a punishment for that person to live with that figure? Does it not seem like a punishment? They must hate for the way that they look, right? To go through all that to change it? I mean, it's not a mere annoyance. They actually find it difficult to live with themselves like that. They do. People find it unlivable. So they're willing to go under the knife and pay whatever the cosmetic surgeons charge them and then go through any of the side effects of all that, taking all the drugs and the painkillers and all that, and sometimes even risking their lives. Why? Because they have given themselves a punishment. And what is that punishment? Not practicing the Dhamma. That's the punishment. Because the Dhamma is your savior. I doubt anyone in this audience will ever go through that. If you have done in the past, you have done. But I doubt anyone in this audience will go through that in the future. Because now you understand that the problem is not the external image. The problem is the image in the back of your mind. This image of perfection. This illusion of beauty. Which was not yours to begin with. But the people that you associated, media did that to you, the newspapers did that to you, social media did that to you, Facebook did that to you, and they just kept on feeding stuff into your heads. You had nothing to check it against. You had nothing to verify that against. You just kept on absorbing, like a sponge absorbs water. You just kept on absorbing these indoctrinations. And today, you have to compare everything that comes in front of your eyes with that image. So therefore, you suffer. There's no answer but the Dhamma. What do you think young girls today should be given? Teenagers? You know, teenage girls as young as 13, 14, 15. I know young girls who are saving up money. They're as young as 14. The same age as your daughter, right? Saving up money, ladies and gentlemen. Say they're saving up lunch money. In the hope that one day they can save up enough to get a breast enlargement. Can you see how much life has become a punishment to them? Living has become a punishment to them. Because here's what they do. They wake up in the morning, they go in front of the mirror and they look at themselves and go, "This is what I have to live up with." It feels like God has been unfair to them. It feels like, you know, they've been destined to live that way. All because of these indoctrinations that have kept on feeding nonsense into their heads. And no one's been there to guide them. Because the parents were far too busy teaching them science and maths and sociology and physiology and physics and sending them abroad and sending them to universities and so on. Especially if you have children who you plan on sending to foreign countries, the way Europe and all these parts of the world, you know, there, these things are big, I tell you. This is mainstream. At least in our countries, it's still only just catching up. But in those countries, these things are massive. They are big. So remember, your children are even more vulnerable to these indoctrinations. So if you want to send your child abroad for their higher education, before you do that, please introduce the Dhamma to them. And it's not just the girls, it's the boys as well now. Because society has fed ideas into their minds about the proportions of their bodies and how various things should be various sizes. I need not say any more, do I? So they do all sorts of self-mortification. Where's the limit to this? Because today, this looks good. Tomorrow they say, this looks good. Now what do you do? Just think about it. Because after all, it's just an indoctrination. And the world, you know, those people out there, the people who are there to make money, they decide what and the image of perfection needs to be. The advertisers decide that. Not the mother or the father. Advertisers decide that. So today they say, this is good. Tomorrow they say, this is good. No? You already had the surgery for this. Now what do? Put them back? This is the plight that young people find themselves in today. You have a duty response, and you have a duty you can't walk yourself out of, folks. If you brought a child into this world, make sure you give them the Dhamma. Otherwise, they were better off wherever they were before coming into your womb. Being a mother is a blessing, yes. But not just because you gave birth to a child. It's because as a mother, you can now help this child to free themselves from suffering. That is the real blessing. Now one day if your child thinks to themselves, why oh why? Was I born to this woman who I have to call my mother? They didn't teach me anything useful. They educated me, sent me abroad to get my grades, get my certificates, get my qualifications. But my mother never taught me about the four great hells. My mother never taught me about good and bad, about virtues and qualities. My mother never taught me about any of this stuff. My mother never taught me that beauty is simply an illusion. And look at all the things that I had to put myself through. Won't they curse you for having given birth to them? Mothers, fathers, what if your child ends up cursing you for having given birth to them? Because giving birth is a simple thing. It's a biological process. But then raising a child to go on to become a great human being, that's no easy task. It takes a whole village to raise a child. The teachers are involved. The Mahasangha has to get involved. The parents have to get involved and be involved 24/7. But most of the time, parents are today only with the children for 3 or 4 hours a day. And those 3 or 4 hours also are also the hours that they're asleep. So actually, most children hardly at all get any time to be with their parents. But at school, they're with their friends. And their friends are indoctrinated by all the other people around them. You don't know who your child is going to sit next to in school. You don't know these things. That's why even Guru Hanuman always reminds you, just because you have brought a child into this world, don't stop at thinking that giving them a good education, giving them enough money to stand up straight and stand up on their own in life, giving them some property, giving them a house, these are the only things that a parent has to do. You can teach them, yes, education is necessary, but you can't draw the line there. Do you remember anything you learned in your last birth? Do you? But all the merits that you did in your last birth, that has brought you human life, hasn't it? See, that's all that remained. You were born today as human beings to good parents because of all the things you learned in your last birth or because of all the merits you did in your last birth. There you go. I drop my case. But we give very little value to such things in today's society. I need you to stand out of that crowd. I need you to think differently. Make a change in this world, make a change to yourselves and make a change to your families. Be a positive influence on everyone that comes into your life. Starting with your family, starting with your children. And you can do that because we now have the refuge of the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. I care deeply about all of you, ladies and gentlemen. It is my duty as a member of the Mahasangha to be like that. I have gone through this experience, this internal transformation. I have gone through it and I'm going through it. So I know the bliss that it brings. And so I just want all of you to have it. Honestly, if you could put your mind, if you could telepathically think about what I'm thinking right now, if you keep your mind to my mind and think about exactly what I'm thinking right now, tears of compassion would start flowing through your eyes. Because you would understand how passionately I care about this, the cause that we are here to do, to achieve. People are dying every day. Next week I'll bring you a video to show you how fortunate you are to have been born human. You heard of the 7 wonders, haven't you? Yes, the 7 wonders. We've taken our own spin on that. There are a different 7 wonders that you need to know. Next week I'll show you what those 7 wonders are. It's not the Taj Mahal. It's not the Leaning Tower of Pisa. We've taken our own spin on what the 7 wonders are. Next week I'll show you that. Perhaps after you watch that, maybe, as well, you'll begin to understand what awaits you, what you've got today, and what you need to do with what you have. So let's work towards that. So over the next week, every time you experience beauty, this is your task for your homework. If you can't do it every time, at least do a handful of times. So that if I ask you next week, can you name the 5 times you did it, you can. Yeah, a handful of times at the very least. Whenever you experience beauty, even if when you see yourself in the mirror and you think this is beautiful, you like what you see in the mirror, you still ask yourself, how am I seeing beauty in me? Is it that I am beautiful, or that in my mind I have an image of what beauty looks like, and these two things right now tally, they match. That is why you see beauty. Finally, someone asked me at the end of last week's sermon, then how come we see ugly? Yeah, if you see beauty, then how come we see ugly? Beauty is when your mental image matches with the external image. So what is ugly then? When there's a mismatch. That's when it's ugly. The closer the match, the more beautiful you perceive something to be. The lesser the match, the more ugly you perceive something to be. That's simple as that. Have you heard of this term called upadana? It appears in dependent origination. Upadana is the stage at which you create a mental image in your mind, and that's called the upadana rupa. In your mind, you have an image of what good looks like. This is the rupa to which you attach. That's why you have tanha paccaya upadana. Vedana paccaya tanha, tanha paccaya upadana. Once you attach, now you have an image of what perfection, what beauty looks like. It is against that image you always contrast and compare whatever image that comes in through your eyes. And it's not just eyes. Ears, nose, smell, taste, they all fit the same bill. So just like you have an image of what beauty looks like through your eyes, you also have an image of what beauty looks like through your ears. So it's not looks like, but beauty sounds like. So we call it melodious. What pleasant sounds like. That's why some like rock music, others like classical music. Some like blues, others like jazz. Why this variation? Why this variety? Again, because of our indoctrinations. When you were born, you had no affinity to one or the other. But as you grew up, these indoctrinations settled in your minds. I, for one, love classical music because my parents loved classical music. All we listened to at home was Amaradev and Nandamani. That's all we had at home. That used to be my lullaby. I used to fall asleep to their songs. So I grew up loving those songs. And the Edward Jayakudis and those people, those singers, they became the artists that I loved. Those are the voices that I loved. As I grew up, those were the voices that I loved. So I learned those songs. And then when I sung them, people appreciated them. Once again, affirming that my choice was right. So this feedback you always get from society. And that feedback confirms that your drishti is right. And then you continue doing that. And then again you get the feedback. And this feedback goes into a feedback loop. So it becomes like a, you want to call it vicious or virtuous cycle. And this is the product that we are today. So ultimately, you are the product of a series of calculations. You started at 0, or let's say you started at 1. Today, you are a number so large. All of these are calculations that have happened at every step of the way. Many multiplications, many divisions, many integrations, many subtractions. All of these have happened to you with every encounter you've had with someone who walked into your life and said something. Something you watched on TV and you heard something. Something you read in a magazine and that you read something. All of these things have had an influence on that number. Today, whatever number you are, that is the product of all those calculations that have happened throughout your life. And has it stopped now? Has it stopped? No, because I'm doing some additions right now. I'm having an influence on your life right now. Because you let me. You can stay at home and not let me do this. Your choice. Right, let's conclude for today then. Okay, so let us take a moment to transfer all the merits that we have acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swami Nuhansi to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along, practice the Dhamma and attain to Nibbana. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer this message to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhansi, as well as all the monks resident in the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer this message to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to attend to the sermons. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery and to those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits from mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who've gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've spared no blood, sweat or tears on our behalf. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have, I beg your pardon, if may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they rejoice in these merits, and may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life that we do, as well as to practice the path in peace and harmony and attain to Nibbana. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great sacrifices on our behalf, including the members of the armed force as well as the police force who protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer these merits to all those who lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, people who have gone every distance to make our lives comfortable as much as they possibly could. Therefore, out of compassion and loving kindness and a sense of gratitude, let us transfer these merits to all of them, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, May they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day and throughout samsara, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. May you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Theranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen nidatnva, desha ginnen nidatnva, moha ginnen nidatnva, nibbana parana sukhayan, sukhita taravatnva, nibbana parana sukhayan, sukhita taravatnva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo, nibbana parana sukhayan, sukhita taravatnva, nibbana parana sukhayan, sukhita taravatnva, nibbana parana sukhayan, sukhita taravatnva. Raga gini niveva, desha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sata laneva, nivan sata ladeva, nivan sata ladeva.
Tunduvange suvisi ananta maha guna velin siru loka siru satyona nibbana parama sukhen sukti paravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.